Fastamai, good evening and welcome to tonight's edition of Island Life with me, Siobhan Fletcher. Today, people across the nation have been taking a moment out of their day to remember those who've died in conflict and those who served in our armed forces. This evening, to round off our coverage here on Manx Radio, we'll be hearing more about those Manx forces who had a different experience of war. I sat down with Dr. Stacey Astle, who specialises through her research on Manx prisoners of war and their experiences abroad. Now, Stacey's own grandfather was captured in Crete. To get things started, I asked her to tell me about his experience.
So I'm fully involved in this topic by accident. I was completely intentional on studying something to do with post-Soviet Poland. And then during my master's, I very briefly thought, oh, that's an interesting conference about prison experience. Oh, my grandfather was a prisoner of war. I'll ask him about that. There's not really much written about the Manx prisoners. So I spoke to him about it and did this conference paper, and that was it. I was absolutely fascinated. There was so much to learn, but also so much tied up in the topic. And I think what I found so fascinating about it is the fact that it's not just one single thing. It's not just looking at prisoners of war. It's looking at all sorts of topics around creativity and resilience and mental health and all of these fantastic things. There's a lot of sadness tied up in it, but there's also a lot of perseverance and joy and resilience that I think is so important to study as well.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk for probably hours about the camps that were on the Isle of Man, which I find fascinating. But you look at the list of names of people who were sort of interned here. Unbelievable. So yeah, you talk about creativity, it was all there.
That's it. There's a lot of parallels between the camps that were over here and the kind of camps I study over in Europe. So with our topic, I kind of look at the Manxmen that were held abroad over in Germany and occupied territories. However, what you get here as well is a lot of similarities, because obviously captivity, it breeds a similar kind of circumstance.
So let's dive in then to your granddad then, and what kind of set you off on this journey. I mean, tell me a bit about him.
Yeah, so my grandfather was Alan Blatz Barrett. He lived to be 98, which was a wonderful long life for him, and also gave me a lot of opportunity to talk to him and find out more about his experiences during the war. So Grando was part of the Manx Regiment, and he was part of the 129th, who were the 3rd Battalion of the Manx Regiment, and they were a light anti-aircraft group, which meant that they were responsible for guarding the skies, essentially. So they were using the Bofors guns to defend Crete. As we know, Crete fell in 1941, which did then mean a large chunk of the men on there were captured, which did include the majority of the 129th. So this led to a situation where a lot of Manxmen were held prisoner. Now, even though there's a lot written about the prisoners of war over here, there's not necessarily much written about the prisoners of war who were held there. So it was quite an interesting topic to start digging into. There are a couple of fantastic books, but there's not the kind of material that there is elsewhere. There also wasn't a huge amount of memoir literature and things like that, which was why it was so significant to be able to have conversations with some of these groups and look at some of the other great conservation work that people had done with those memories. So in terms of Granda, it was great to be able to just talk to him about these experiences, even though obviously it was quite difficult for him. He was, however, like many prisoners of war, quite reluctant to speak too much about it until, for him, I was doing it for university. At that point, it was different, and he was willing to tell me more. But a lot of these men didn't necessarily think what they'd done was remarkable. There was also a bit of judgment that he spoke about. So when he returned to the island, he said some people would cross the road to avoid him, because a lot of people would hold the perception that people in the camps were cowards or were out of the war and were safe while other people were out fighting. So this meant that I think he didn't necessarily talk about it as much as he could have, or as broadly as he might have otherwise. There was also a lot of things tied up around how long it took them to get their campaign medals and things like this. So they did eventually get their medals for Crete, but it took a very long time. It was within my lifetime that he got his. So in the camps, he was initially taken on Crete, as I've mentioned. Then they were taken over to mainland Greece, and then from there they were moved through into what's now Poland, but what was at the time Upper Silesia. Malaysia. So he was held for most of his time in a camp called Stalagate B. Now, this is one of the big camps. It's one of the ones that a lot of men would move through. There were different kinds of camps depending on what kind of armed forces you were fighting with, but he was with the army, so that was where he travelled through. He did then move out to a working camp, so he was in a working camp for a big chunk of his time. With working camps, not every prisoner of war was required to work, but those who weren't of a higher status. So if you were a non-commissioned officer, you could only be required to work in a supervisory capacity, and if you were an officer, you didn't have to work at all. You couldn't be compelled, but everyone else of other ranks had to work if they were told to. So he went off to this working camp and worked in a woodwool factory. So he was actually quite positive about his time there. He worked with some German civilians and actually got some training around joinery, which was a bit of what he'd been training in before the war, but managed to complete his training afterwards, but had that time while he was away to actually learn these skills. One of the things he always talked about was the little pedestal mats that he made for the men, which were for use in the toilets. Now, when we think of toilets, obviously, we're probably not thinking of what was going on in the camps there. They had more of a long drop situation for anyone that's been to Leeds Festival and is familiar.
Horrifying.
Yes. So you have more of a row of holes in a plank of wood. Mm-hmm. This was essentially what the toilets were. So obviously it could get very cold and be difficult for the men. So he made some little mats of interlocking bits of wood just to try and help provide a little bit of comfort from the mud and things like that that were happening in there. So during his time in camp, he managed to do some productive things as well. He also kept some little playbills and other bits and pieces from his time, including some of the shows that they were putting on in camps, which again might seem like something you wouldn't initially think of, but of course when you're trapped in this kind of situation, most of what you have is a lot of time on your hands. Mm-hmm. And when you have a lot of time on your hands, you tend to lean on creativity or other pursuits just to try and fill that time. So things like sports and creative pursuits and performance art were really, really common in the camps because it was something that could be done, yes, in very extravagant ways, but also in very basic ways. If you have a couple of jumpers and something you can make a ball, you can make a football match go. If you've got, you know, a couple of jumpers, you can use them as marking out the start and finish line of a race. You can even use some men to do that. And then from there, you don't only entertain the people that are taking part, but also all of those spectators as well. So these kind of things ended up being great time killers.
I mean, it's almost mad to us now, knowing the context that we know, that people would be like, oh, you just had an easy time, you know, when actually you were probably, you know, it was not a place you would want to be. I mean, I don't know if he told you, you know, how he sort of handled that, I suppose, going forward with the rest of his life back on the island.
So I don't know a huge amount about it because that wasn't something he necessarily spoke about too much. And I was always careful not to pull too hard at any strands that I thought might be distressing for him. Part of that level of interviewing was having to consider how formally I was doing it, but also thinking about the kind of ethics of it as well. So I tended to keep to what he was happy to volunteer to me. I did ask a little bit about it, and I think one of the key things is just that because a lot of the men, and this is a pattern I notice as well in all the media that I look at around it, because I don't just study Manx prisoners of war, I study the prisoners of war who were allied men who were held in Europe. So this is something you see a bit more broadly as well. There's got to be that element of stiff upper lip that's coming through in quite a few letters. Not universally, some men were writing about what a bad time they were having, but a lot of the time they're just trying not to worry people at home. So they're saying, you know, oh, and this is happening and we did a race today and, you know, we had this event today. And there was also the Red Cross magazine. There was a few different versions of it, but the one was the Prisoner of War Update Bulletin. And basically this would be sent out to the families of people who were prisoners of war to try and reassure them essentially and give them news from the camps. So it would have things in it like, oh, they're growing a garden in this camp and they're doing this in this camp and here's a picture of them. And obviously that's helpful to a level and it's true to a level, but it didn't necessarily give the fullness of the experience. Mm. And there were some stories in these magazines about some of the bad things that were happening, but they certainly weren't quite as front and center sometimes as some of the other stories and the kind of puff pieces essentially. So you can see how that would start to build into the concept that, oh, actually, yeah, they're off there like having a party, they're in a holiday camp. There's a great book by Midge Gillies, which is written about letters that prisoners received. And there's some fantastic stuff in there, like, oh, shall I send your golf clubs through for you? And this kind of thing, which you can imagine how distressing that is.
Yeah.
And this is something that gets written in some of the men's diaries as well. There's kind of these joking pieces that come up time and time again. There was a lot of people that were getting broken up with. The Dear John letter was very common, sadly. But it did mean that they started to have things in place to deal with this. And I have heard as well that since, from the Lieutenant Governor, who very kindly told me that this was actually something they did while he was away as well. But they would post up the letter somewhere in camp if someone was broken up with, and then they would critique it. And this was just a way of, I guess, helping deal with quite a common problem. But letters that get shared in the diaries would include things like, oh, dear blah, 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 I've married your father, love mother. And, you know, I would much rather date a 1945 hero than a 1939 coward. Mm. And things along these lines. So even when they're in the camps, there's that kind of concept that there's cowardice tied up with this and that they're safe and out of the way of the war, whereas the real men are off fighting. Mm.
Did you find anything out about, like, you know, maybe a bit more of the reality of his situation? I know we talked about him working, but just about, like, conditions and things in the camp.
Yeah, so this isn't something he really talked about a lot, and it's tricky to know exactly why. I think part of it is that for a lot of people, it was just what happened. And especially when you've come back after some kind of extreme situation like the war, everyone has their stories and everyone has these things that have happened to them. And there's a lot to think about and consider there. But I wonder if it also lends itself to thinking, well, my experience isn't that, you know, exciting. And I think COVID is a good example of that. Obviously, we lived through this really big thing where so many extreme things happened. You know, everybody stayed inside for several months. That's not normal, but because everyone did it, I don't know if anyone would necessarily think, oh, my experience, I should really record that and write down day to day what was happening. And with him, it wasn't something he necessarily talked about that much. But we do know just from, you know, reading things like Red Cross reports, because the Red Cross were going in and checking in on the conditions, making sure the camps were safe and livable, meeting with the standards of the Geneva Convention, which was essentially the convention relative to the treatment of prisoners of war from 1929, which both Germany and the UK were signed up to, which meant that our prisoners were protected by it. So there were standards set out in that about the living conditions and what should be experienced. However, sadly, that usually wasn't being met, in part because it was wartime and there was a lot of people to hold, and it wasn't easy to do that. It wasn't easy to feed them and clothe them and do everything that needed to be done. But in the camps, there could be situations where, you know, the showers would only be available during set periods of time and they wouldn't be hot necessarily. Men would often have to craft their way around issues such as a lack of available ways to cook. So blower stoves became quite common, which were essentially tin can contraptions to make sure that they were able to heat things. And the bunks themselves, like the places the men were sleeping, in Stalagate B, there were definitely triple layer bunks. These wouldn't be well put together ones either. There's a lot of really funny drawings of men kind of like falling through bunks onto the people below them, which is humorous but also based very much in truth, especially when fuel was short, because of course bed boards are a fantastic source of wood, so they may start to disappear, which did then mean that men were sleeping on less and less boards and there was much more risk of them kind of falling through in the middle of the night. Conditions were generally very dirty. There was also risk of people thieving. It's not something that's hugely broadly talked about, but there were gangs in the camps in some cases who were, you know, stealing what they could, taking what they could. And especially in times when you have extreme hunger, which they did, if things were available, they may end up not being available anymore. This is especially true in terms of clothing as well. These were things you really had to consider. When you were freezing, you wanted to have everything with you. And some of the men were worried about kind of leaving their greatcoats anywhere, just because would they be there when they got back? It's hard to say. There was a lot of honour in the camps, but there was also always going to be, in a large group, some people who aren't necessarily acting in the same way. And also, you've also got to consider just the fact that people were desperate. The food situation I've kind of alluded to, but it was very poor. When Grander was first captured, he would talk about the food situation as being, you got a cup of vitamin tea from the Red Cross in the morning, and that was it. So that was kind of all you got through the day. Mostly the diet would consist of like an Ersatz coffee, so it wasn't actually coffee, and they all have a lot of complaints about it. There was also some bad tea as well sometimes. And then through the day, there was kind of a watery soup, or, you know, with not very good quality stuff in it, or some kind of stew. Again, similarly, poor quality meat and veg in there, in some cases rotting. There's one prisoner of war who had a real aversion to potatoes with skin on, just because that was always used to hide the mold inside them and how bad they'd gone in the camps. So there really wasn't high quality food available to them until the Red Cross started sending parcels. And these Red Cross parcels were supposed to be able to feed a man for a week. They are essentially credited with saving the lives of many, many prisoners. When you read prisoner accounts, you'll often see a huge amount of gratitude for the Red Cross and everything they did. The food parcels were really significant, and they also sent some comfort parcels and things like that as well. But really, the food that they sent was so significant in the experience of the prisoners, and it's something that most of them would mention somewhere, just because it meant so much to them. And as well as being, obviously, the food, which is wonderful and needed, it was also that little taste of home as well. Because if you imagine going for ages and ages with, you know, just this bad stew, bad soup, to then actually get some real food, but also for it to be something you recognised with a label you knew, I can't even imagine how significant that could be.
You're listening to a special edition of Island Life with me, Siobhan Fletcher, marking Remembrance Day. We're in conversation with Dr. Stacey Astle, whose grandfather was captured in Crete. Let's jump back into that conversation.
How much have you been able to kind of uncover, I suppose, about Manx prisoner of war? Have you gone beyond your grandfather? Have you found out about many more?
Yeah, so because there was such a chunk of them captured, there is a lot of really interesting stuff in the newspapers. And that might sound a bit odd, but basically people would write home and then their parents would share those writings home and pop them in the newsletters. There was also somebody captured who worked for one of the Manx newspapers. I can't remember off the top of my head which one it was, I'm afraid. And he would write to the newspapers to be shared in the camp, of his experiences in the camp, so that would get published as well. So just on the Eye Museum, there's loads of amazing resources there, just actually from the war, which is fantastic. There was also John Stevenson, bless him, who was incredible. I managed to do an interview with him, and he very kindly gifted me a book that gave lots of insight about the experiences as well. That one was a more general book, but he did talk to me about his experience. And actually for him, there was a really interesting exchange where his Manxness was a level of protecting factor. He was also engaged in working, and had been working, I think he was digging something to do with a paper mill. So they were merrily laying the pipes down and smashing every single pipe that went in so that nothing would work by the time it was finished, which again, that level of resistance is very significant too. But he was engaged in this work, and a German saw something to do with the island, I think on his shoulder or something like that, and came over to him and asked if he was from the Isle of Man. And it turned out he'd been interned on the island during the First World War. So I think he brought him some extra food or something like that after just on that day. But yeah, just that level of being Manx and being recognised was helpful.
The power of the Isle of Man there, I mean, for you, how was it sort of getting to hear these stories from your granddad? I imagine that it probably wouldn't have been easy necessarily talking on a personal note, but do you feel like you've kind of now, I mean, you're obviously telling me his story, it feels like it gets to live on a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing to be able to do, is just kind of share these accounts and stories. A lot of people go in with a perception of what camp life was like, with the kind of, you know, jolly hockey sticks approach, or there's kind of thoughts around like the Great Escape film and all those amazing things. But that wasn't really the day-to-day of it. So actually, just to be able to talk to him about kind of, you know, what food he was eating and what things he was doing day-to-day, and, you know, just the regularity of going into the wool factory and doing bits and pieces there, it was really interesting to just get to hear about, but also to get to then do something with that. So to be able to put down the experiences of Manx prisoners and things like that. Yeah. Just in terms of that Manx experience as well, there was a Timwald Club formed, which was a group of Manx men or men with Manx connections. So in one of the camps, they would literally just meet to share letters and things like that. Because, of course, by the nature of the Isle of Man, often somebody would know somebody being mentioned in one of the letters. So it brought that kind of familiarity from home as well. Yeah. And there was that connection happening.
So obviously you've been told several anecdotes from your granddad as you were sort of doing all your research. Tell me maybe some of the more interesting things that he sort of told you that maybe sound fresh out of a film. I mean, there's a lot.
So one of the things that I think is most interesting, because he didn't tell me, is actually the fact that when I was starting to look through the archives to see if I could find any letters he might have sent, I actually found some stories from his brother trying to find him. So his brother had seen him not long before and hadn't seen him again, and then Crete had fallen. So at this point, he was desperately trying to work out what had happened, whether, you know, Grandad was okay, whether he'd been injured, whether he was captured. There was just a lot of confusion around this, and therefore he was kind of appealing for information just to try and find out what was happening. Now, one of the things that did happen regularly with this, obviously there's so much confusion during a war, it's very hard to keep absolute track of everyone. So with prisoners of war, there was sometimes cases where people would be informed that their son had died or was missing in action, and then they would later be found to be in a camp. And you didn't always get the kind of standard route of being informed by the government first. There was broadcasts being done by the Vatican and by other places as well to try and keep track of the men that were captured. So sometimes these broadcasts would have people's names, and then they'd get written to let them know that it had been on this broadcast that the person was okay. So I don't still know how that information officially reached them, but I do know that there was a while where poor Wilbur wasn't quite sure what was happening and really needed to try and work out where my grandfather was.
What next for you as well? Is this like, clearly it's an ongoing interest, is it an ongoing project for you, you know, what are you researching at the moment?
So actually I'm looking at the way that the prisoners of war were represented in the press. So I'm looking at the Eye Museum at the moment and considering what was being put in the papers and how that might have impacted the perception of the public. And one of the things that's really amazing is just seeing how much support there was in terms of the charity and how much people were giving and donating in terms of both the kind of cigarette funds, which was a very important element of camp life, both for being able to smoke, but also being able to use it as a currency, because of course a cigarette is a small kind of thing, but they're very standard. So you have like one unit of currency, which makes life quite easy in terms of that barter and exchange. So being able to provide things like that and the amount of different events that were going on, there was all sorts of things happening. There was one pub that did a thing with a mirror where they had a mirror laid out and you put coins on it to make a pattern in the mirror, and when it was full that would get donated. There was all sorts of competitions happening and different kinds of celebrations and dances and all sorts of things to raise money and support the prisoners. So it wasn't that everybody felt they were, you know, safe and didn't need that. There was a huge effort from the island to provide that support, but I think it's just that some of the ways it was being represented could also kind of lean into that thinking.
I guess my final question, like I said, I could talk to you for hours, but you've mentioned a few times using like the Eye Museum, and are you finding that is like a really good resource then for this Manx experience?
Yeah, the Eye Museum is a fantastic resource. There's so many newspaper records that are just freely available, digitised, and you can grab them. You can also save the documents and things like that. So it's a fantastic thing to be able to have. I'd suggest, you know, if you know that you've got family locally, just pop in the names and see what you get. I found some fabulous things about the family over the years, not just specifically in relation to this. But if you are interested in the prison of war experience, it's probably worth just looking prisoner of war, or even chuck in a camp name. So if you put in like Stalag 8B or something along those lines, Stalag Luft 3, pick one, it will then bring you up hopefully some articles or that people have published just sharing bits of information. There's not necessarily hugely in-depth bits and pieces, but there is just loads on there.
You've been listening to a special edition of Island Life to mark Remembrance Day here on the Isle of Man. We've been talking to Dr. Stacey Astell, whose grandfather was captured in Crete and was a prisoner of war for many years over in Europe. Now, people around the nation took a moment out of their day to pause and remember those who've died in conflict and served in our armed forces. It seems only right that we end this special edition of Island Life with another moment to pause and remember them. This has been Island Life. Thank you very much for joining us here on Manx Radio. If you'd like to listen back to the conversation tonight, you can listen again wherever you get your podcasts.